Word of mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott.
I need you to put all the cash in a bag for me. You, pies. Give me some of the good pies.
This is Dougie's sister, Megan.
Oh, this is some classy... Jeez, Megan. I'm sorry, I want to apologize. I'm not even confident of which end that came out of. Could you just close the door on the way out?
I'll shut the door on you. Will you lay down here, put your head in the door, and I'll slam it about 157,000 times.
Clips of Melissa McCarthy from her latest movie, Tammy, her Oscar-nominated role as Megan in the 2011 hit Bridesmaids, and alongside Sandra Bullock in the 2013 buddy cop movie, The Heat. McCarthy, often called America's plus-size sweetheart, has publicly dismissed criticisms of her size in interviews, while simultaneously starring in raunchy comedies that use her weight as the punchline. Freelance writer and editor Laura Bogart asked whether Melissa McCarthy can indeed be a role model for body acceptance. Laura wrote, "Is Melissa McCarthy a big sellout?" which ran on the website Dame Magazine. Laura Bogart, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So this is, your article begins with a personal story for you, contemplating dressing as a movie character. Want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so I'm a big Quentin Tarantino fan, and I'm a huge Kill Bill fan. It's my favorite movie, and I had seen the movie so many times in theaters that when a group of friends decided we were going to dress as the Deadly Viper Assassination Squad, I was in sort of naturally picked to be the bride, who in Kill Bill Volume 1, as you recall, wears that wonderful...
That yellow tracksuit,
which is inspired by Bruce Lee in one of his last movies. And we were, like, really excited talking about this. And, you know, I, as I say in the piece, I am a plus-size woman myself. And, you know, an acquaintance who was with the group, you know, sort of made a comment, well, are you sure you can really wear that, basically, to the effect of, you know, a woman my size should not be wearing a suit like that. And it really sort of took the wind out of my sails and the excitement about dressing up that way. So, you know, I ended up going as just, you know, your garden variety zombie that year instead of, you know, doing what I really wanted to do, which was going as Uma in all of her grandeur.
Well, not a lot of examples of plus-size actors. So when you saw Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids, you were looking forward to seeing a plus-size star. What did you think of her role?
Well, you know, I remember seeing the posters of that movie and sort of walking past it and thinking, oh, you know, here's someone who looks like me. And when I went to the movie, you know, I've got to be honest, I was pretty horrified at that character, you know, the walking, talking stereotype that we have of women of size. You know, she's very loud, she's abrasive, she's obsessed with food, she doesn't dress well, she's rough-hewn. You know, when she expresses her sexuality and her desire, it's shown as gross and funny instead of just being an honest display of desire and, you know, feeling attracted to people. I was really hurt. You know, I think that's the word. I was really, really hurt by what I saw.
So it felt personal for you. Why? There was something about laughing at her rather than laughing with her that struck you as personal?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, I live in a culture where, you know, a size 12 is considered the beginning point of plus size in some instances. And, you know, I'm a size 24, so I don't see representations of myself and my body type on screen very often. And, you know, growing up and struggling with weight as I've grown up, you know, these are the things that I always sort of had to deal with and the, you know, stereotypes that I would encounter. And to see them sort of writ large in that way and to see someone with my body type, you know, not just enduring them, but perpetuating them and being complicit in the display of them for such a large audience and for such a large screen, it felt really personal. It felt really deeply hurtful.
But yet in interviews, Melissa McCarthy has admonished the fashion industry for not making clothes in her size, come out against critics who focus on her weight. but then portrays these characters whose weight is the stereotypical punchline. Well, what's the message that she's sending to plus-sized women?
Well, you know, that's a really interesting point. Like, I read her recent interview with People magazine, and she talked very explicitly about being an Oscar-nominated and an Emmy award-winning actress who could not find designers who were willing to, you know, clothe her for these big events. And, you know, she even talks about, well, you know, I want something that doesn't look like a tent. I want something that fits me well, which is something that I relate to, and I think a lot of women of size absolutely relate to. And then in a movie like Tammy, she's slovenly. And in fact, there's a plot point that hinges on the fact that she wears this sort of gross T-shirt, that Mahalo T-shirt that she's wearing in the teaser trailer. And it basically sends the message that, you know, we can talk the talk, but at the end of the day, you know, this is what fat women get. We get the tent dresses. We get the ugly clothes. And it's funny.
We're talking with the freelance writer and editor Laura Bogart about Melissa McCarthy, the so-called America's plus-size sweetheart. And Laura's article asks whether Melissa McCarthy is disappointing the many fans that are looking to her as a role model for body acceptance instead of, again, playing the funny fat lady. Laura, let's acknowledge that there is often a difference between personal feelings, advocacy, self-image, and the limitations of Hollywood movie roles.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe, you know, Melissa McCarthy may feel like she has to play these kind of roles.
Well, you know, the thing that's interesting about that is that she and her husband co-wrote Tammy, and her husband directed it. So she was in a unique position with Tammy where she was able to sort of create the character that she wanted to. And the movie has not done well critically, and it's not done well at the box office. And I think that what that shows us is that there are a lot of people who are ready for something fresh and ready for something new from her. And a lot of the response that I've gotten from my article, you know, people writing me, you know, people who know me coming and talking to me, they're saying, you know, I completely agree with you. I'm sort of tired of seeing her do the same role over and over again. So I think that now there is a consensus of people who want something different from her. And we can look to the success of her show, Mike and Molly, which I think is going into its fourth or fifth year. It's a very popular and successful sitcom, and it hits all the pleasure spots that a typical sitcom hits. And, you know, yes, she's a woman of size in that show, and yes, they meet at Overeaters Anonymous, but by and large, she's allowed to be just a typical woman in a sitcom, and she deals with all of the things that, you know, women in sitcoms deal with, getting along with her in-laws, you know, finding the career that suits her. She has these plot lines and these storylines that are contingent on things that are not based on her weight, and the show is incredibly popular.
Hold that thought for a minute, because I'd like to talk about television. Here's a clip from an episode of Louis C.K.'s show that got a lot of attention. In the episode, he's out on a date with this plus-sized waitress that he met at a comedy club, and she's smart and she's funny, and after asking him out several times, he goes out with her. Here's their conversation.
You're not fat.
Ah, oh, damn it. That is so disappointing, Louis.
You're not. I mean...
Louie, do you know what the meanest thing is you can say to a fat girl? You're not fat. I mean, come on, buddy.
I'm sorry.
Laura Bogart, that episode of Louis C.K. was applauded for its courage, its sensitivity. Do you think that that was deserved?
You know, I have a lot of feelings about that episode. I'm a fan of Louis, and I admire him for trying to take on this issue. And the thing that I really like about that episode is that it definitely looks at sort of double standards that we have between men of size and women of size. And the character even calls him out on that at one point, saying, you know, a man of your size is still considered attractive. You can go into the comedy clubs and you're still funny. And it's exponentially harder for someone like me. And I think, by and large, the first part of that, you know, where she's talking to him, it's good to me up until the point where she says, you know, I don't really want a boyfriend or a husband. You know, she says, I just want someone to hold my hand. And, you know, I watched that, you know, as a viewer, and my heart just sort of sunk because I thought, really? that's all you want? You know, she pursued him pretty avidly throughout the show. He turns her down like twice. And then she goes and gets these hockey tickets. She knows that he'll be hard pressed to resist. And so I sat there and thought, you know, you've been pursuing this guy pretty hard. It seems to me like maybe you want more. And especially since she talks to him at one point, you know, he says, you know, I've been with fat women before. And she calls him on it and says, you know, maybe you've had sex with fat women, but you've never walked hand in hand with one in daylight. And that was also an incredibly powerful and resonant line for me.
So, of course, we have this double standard. I mean, if Melissa McCarthy's movie was called Tommy instead of Tammy, we wouldn't be having this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But what would you have Melissa McCarthy do? You know, among the commenters of your article, many said, okay, so what is she supposed to become, some sort of advocate for oversized women? Why are you having Melissa McCarthy stand for so much?
Well, you know, the thing is, Melissa McCarthy is incredibly visible. And, you know, whether she likes it or not, she's sort of the first one out of the gate. She's talked very eloquently about, you know, being a woman of size and struggling with that. And I think as an artist, I'd like to see her maybe tap into some of that empathy and think, what can I do? And what can I do is actually really just expanding herself artistically and creating more nuanced roles that would challenge her as an actress and a comedian. You know, I often see her compared to Adam Sandler or Will Ferrell. The thing that people forget about that is that Adam Sandler did Punch Drunk Love and Will Ferrell did Stranger Than Fiction, which are sort of movies outside of their wheelhouse. So I'd like to see her sort of move in that direction and play real women. They don't have to be ideals or exemplars of anything, but I think she's an incredibly talented performer and a very deft comedian when she's allowed to be. And I'd like to see her sort of create some of the roles for herself where she gets to be more nuanced.
Laura Bogart, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Laura Bogart is a writer and an editor. Her article on Dame magazine, Is Melissa McCarthy a Big Sellout?, has appeared in several other places online. You can find a link to read it for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. And just a reminder, the finale of NHPR Summer Car Raffle is underway. You can take a chance and support Word of Mouth and all of the NHPR programs that you love by getting your tickets today. Here's how.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Sounds of sword fighting there from NBC series Crossbones, a fictional account of the notorious pirate Edward Blackbeard Teach. You don't have to go far to find Blackbeard and his fellow buccaneers swashbuckling through popular culture. From Robert Louis Stevenson's Treasure Island to Captain Phillips, portrayals of pirates have captured the public's imagination for centuries. But why has such a small group of individuals operating during a relatively short period in the early 18th century left such an enduring legacy? Joining us to explain and clear up some common myths about pirates is Colin Woodard. His book, Republic of Pirates, served as the inspiration for Crossbones. He also was story consultant for the video game Assassin's Creed IV, Black Flag. Colin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, you write about piracy having been around for thousands of years, but the Golden Age, when was that and why so short-lived?
Well, it was one gang of pirates who were responsible for 90% of all our pop culture imagery, and they were operating for a very brief period of time, roughly 1715 to 1719 or 20, and they've remained famous because they were incredibly effective. They were threatening three maritime empires and had the warships of the Royal Navy on the run, and their legacy has been lasting ever since.
Well, and that legacy has captured our imagination. How were they regarded at the time?
They were folk heroes at the time, which is one of the reasons that they remain folk heroes now. These particular pirates, unlike the pirates who came before and the pirates who've come since, didn't see themselves as just being thieves and brigands, but rather as leading a social revolt against the sort of authoritarian powers of an increasingly authoritarian time, especially the ship owners and ship captains who'd made many of their lives miserable when they were serving on merchant vessels. So they considered themselves to be Robin Hood's men, and advertise themselves as such. And many people, ordinary people on both sides of the Atlantic, actually believed their take on events.
Well, adding to their folk hero credibility, at least in retrospect, they also freed slaves on occasion.
Yes, just remember in this early 18th century is a time when the Caribbean was one slave plantation after another, and pirate ship turned out to be one of the few places where people of African descent had the possibility of being free. Pirates allowed African Americans they encountered and runaway slaves to join their ships as equal members of the crews, and some of them even rose to be pirate captains themselves. Not everybody. They also, perplexingly, would trade captured slaves as cargo or plunder. So it's a perplexing period, but yes, the possibility was there.
Well, we do have a very particular image of how a pirate should look and behave. You know, I'm thinking of the mismatched clothes and eye patches and wooden legs, you know, saying things like, avast, or walk the plank. Now, where does that come from, Colin?
Well, a lot of that comes from Robert Newton, the actor's portrayal of Long John Silver and Blackbeard in the early Disney films of the 1950s, Treasure Island and Blackbeard. And he was the one who came up with that sort of what's become since a stock character, that pirate saying, arr, and avast, and so on and so forth. And he was from the West Country of England originally, from Dorset, and was channeling the accent and local dialect of his youth. Now, since many of the pirates were from the West Country, maybe a quarter or a third, it's safe to say that probably some of the pirates may have spoken with an accent resembling the pirate talk we hear, although Newton was definitely greatly exaggerating the accent and hamming it up a great deal.
I want to know where Captain Bellamy is.
Well, he's aboard, all right. I left him hanging around somewhere.
There was a dead man hanging from the yardarm as we came aboard.
Ah, there's a man what's seen him.
Let's look at some of the other ideas that we have about pirates. One, that they bury treasure often yet to be found. True?
Well, Robert Louis Stevenson brought us the idea of pirates burying their treasure. No, there's no real credible accounts of any of the Golden Age pirates or most anyone else digging holes in the ground to put their valuables. And think about it, it doesn't make all that much sense that you would do that. How could you count on all of the men who are witnessing you doing that not being separated from you later and coming back and digging it up? What the pirates, what we do know that they did is they either traded their plunder for things they needed, from rum to naval stores, or if they had a lot of it, they deposited it with trusted people. And there were a few famous brokers out there who would be willing to hold on to black market plunder, and some of them were in fact governors of colonies.
Among the most famous of the pirates, Blackbeard, who is said to have terrorized the New World and have been so terrifying that ships would actually surrender without even putting up a fight. True or false?
It's true. Blackbeard cultivated this visage of terror so that people would be too afraid to fight him and would surrender, and they did. He would light fuses in his beard. So you'd have fire and smoke coming around his head when he went into battle.
Wowie.
So around his, yeah, he had his, he and his men would be carrying bandoliers of pistols and grenades and boarding axes and wearing the gentlemen's clothes and wigs and a hodgepodge of things they'd looted from wealthy passengers in previous captures. And it absolutely terrified the crews of the vessels they were coming to. It looked like something out of a Mad Max movie. So that was the entire plan, though, because Blackbeard didn't want to risk any of his crew being hurt, his vessel being damaged, and he didn't want to damage the vessel he was capturing or its cargo or its crew members, who were the potential recruits and volunteers who would join and swell the mass of the pirates.
So this was all for show? There was no real violence?
In Blackbeard's case, no. I mean, people were absolutely terrified of him, and he became the most feared pirate of all through the media's fixation and reports on him. But if you look through all the documentary evidence, which is pretty voluminous, of Blackbeard's career, and it's all from the victims, it's the depositions of people he captured and court testimony from them, there's not one instance of him hurting or killing anybody prior to his final fatal battle with the Royal Navy. So he scared people, but he actually never applied violence, because in part because he didn't have to. He was a thinking man's pirate and a bit of a chess master, which is why I think he is rightly dominated pop culture thinking about the pirates.
Well, you're talking about some documentary evidence, and this is something that's been studied by scholars for a long time. But how else do we know about the life and world of the pirates?
Well, primarily it is the archival stuff, and some of it was things that I found, you know, bringing to the picture that nobody else had uncovered, things like the captain's logs and captain's letters of the Royal Navy officials who were tasked with gathering intelligence on these pirates and trying to capture him, which scholars had not really dug into in depth. There's also archaeological evidence now. They found both Blackbeard's flagship, the Queen Anne's Revenge, off North Carolina, and before that, off Cape Cod, they found the Widow, which was the wreck of another important captain from this group, Sam Bellamy. And those things gave us all sorts of interesting material evidence as to how the pirates lived and what they'd captured, and sort of as a giant time capsule of what life on a pirate vessel was like.
Blackbeard's exploits and conquests and tactics for staying one step ahead of capture are really the stuff of legend, and supported by some of these newly discovered facts that you write about in your book, which we'll leave to the readers. But how about for you? Any great surprises in what you have discovered or learned about Blackbeard and the lives of the pirates?
Yes, there were many things I found surprising and shocking, beginning with the idea that they thought themselves to be social revolutionaries, but also that many of the pirates among them were actually people who'd been involved in a great conspiracy to restore the Stuart to the throne of England. They'd recently been deposed. And so a lot of them were actually among the pirates, but had a political purpose in the sort of great struggle of dynastic politics of the age. I mean, who knew? And another set of evidence showing that this particular band of pirates we celebrate in pop culture were really unusual figures who weren't just involved in petty crime.
So that's bound up in empire and the age of discovery and the colonial world. Why does the pirate still so captivate our imagination today, Colin?
I think because they grab onto a certain part of us, particularly in this modern era where we're all have very busy lives and we're programmed and the kids need to get to soccer practice and we have to get to our job and we have to commute through traffic. And there are all these benefits of civilization, but somewhere many of us in the back of our head have that impulse. If I could just drive off this freeway and charge out into the open ocean and live a merry life on my own terms with my, you know, band of merry men, most of us wouldn't actually do it, but somewhere there's that certain attraction and appeal of that fantasy. And here among the pirates, particularly in their cleaned-up pop culture version, is crystallizing that spirit, that against terrible risks, they're just going to, you know, throw off the constraints and oppression of society and go and live on their own terms. And so I think that is emotionally what really grabs on to people about it, even as the details, fascinating as they are, had been lost to history as to why they had been folk heroes at the time and continued to be for centuries thereafter.
Okay, to that I say aye. Colin Woodard, author of The Republic of Pirates, which in turn is the inspiration for the series Crossbones, which is airing back-to-back episodes of its two-part season finale this Saturday on NBC. For details, go to wordofmouthradio.org. NHPR's summer car raffle is winding up. You don't have to hit the high seas or use pirate tactics to get your prize. You could win with just a phone call. Here's how to claim your booty. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. When it comes to social media, it seems there's always a new platform for sharing and connecting with others. Just as AOL made way for Gmail and Flickr made way for Instagram, Friendster paved the way for MySpace and MySpace for Facebook. But what happens to the old profiles that we leave behind? Producer Taylor Quimby investigated.
MySpace. One could say it's the velvet leisure suit of social media.
Do you have a MySpace account?
MySpace, yes, actually do.
Do you use it on a regular basis?
I haven't touched it in years, to be honest.
But it's probably still there.
Yes.
It's pretty normal to look back at old outfits and wonder, oh, what was I thinking? history hasn't been kind to hammer pants or the fanny pack. And like the leisure suit, MySpace has suffered the same sort of fate. It's become a punchline.
Do you know anybody that has a MySpace?
Yeah, my dad has a MySpace.
But lest we forget, we're not talking about a trend from 15 or 20 years ago. In fact, it wasn't until 2008 that Facebook users first outnumbered fans of MySpace. Less than 6 years ago. MySpace was the hottest social media platform since Friendster. Remember Friendster? And even today, MySpace claims to have some 36 million users. But who are they? Do you have one? Did you ever have one? And when you decided to move on, did you delete your account?
All right. Let's see if we can find Taylor's MySpace.
Taylor?
That's producer Zach Nugent and my boss, Maureen McMurray.
MySpace.
So, if you haven't already guessed, there's a reason I'm the one telling the story.
Okay, here it is. Oh, my.
That's Taylor. Yeah. That's
oh, what... my God. What is going on here? Let's just... Is that Taylor?
Around 2006 and 7, I was really into MySpace. And then, like many others, I abandoned it. I didn't delete my account, I just kind of drifted away. And since nobody I knew used it anymore, I sort of thought MySpace would just drift away too. But in 2012 and 2013, MySpace redesigned the site to focus on the one demographic still using it, musicians. They ditched the classic MySpace look, and all the blog posts, messages, likes, and dislikes we agonized over, it all got sent to the digital trash bin. All of it except for one thing, the photos. Which means if you haven't deleted your account, its ghost is still there, and your leftover MySpace photos are up for the whole world to see.
Taylor, did you ever have a shaved head?
Shaved head with ping pong balls as eyes?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's you?
Brushing your teeth?
In the MySpace days, I looked a lot different.
And there's one of him.
As like the Joker?
Do you have blood on your face?
Frankly, I didn't use a lot of discretion when posting pictures.
Do we want to just describe this photo?
He's pantsless and he has an axe.
He's in a Speedo. He's in a straight-up Speedo.
My MySpace page was an extension of my musical alter ego at the time, an experimental project I called Milky Pink.
Like this, it looks like you're part of some cult.
It was pretty weird.
I don't know if you can read the caption underneath, but it says Milky Pink, murder capital of the world.
That was, okay, so the explanation here is that was the cover art for my first album as Milky Pink.
That's it?
Yeah.
And that's you?
Yep.
Now, none of this stuff is so bad it would ever get me fired, I think. But should I ever be looking for a new job, it's within the realm of possibility that an employer might see it. And the fact that it's just sitting out there for anybody with an internet connection to see makes me pretty uncomfortable. And work aside, I'm a dad now. I don't plan on hiding my past from my son, but I would like to be able to control how it's presented. So, here it is. The point of this whole story, how to delete your MySpace profile. Step 1. If you know the email and password to your old account, then congratulations. This is going to be a snap. All you have to do is log back in, go to your settings, and select Delete Account. If, like me, though, you don't have a clue what your email address was when you signed up for MySpace, or you signed up with a college email that's since been deactivated, it's a little more complicated. Before you can delete an account, you've got to prove that it's yours to delete. You need to sign the MySpace Declaration of Ownership. It's pretty easy to find once you know what you're looking for. To make it even easier, we've got a link at wordofmouthradio.org. But there is one tricky part. It requires that you attach a digital copy of a government-issued ID. Seriously. Once you've got that done, you can pretty much just fill it out and press send.
All right, I'm doing it, guys. Oh, wait. It's mad at me. What did I fill out here?
The form is going to ask you for all the information we have already established you do not have access to. So you've got to find a workaround, like I did.
Okay, maybe if I just fill out don't know for all those fields.
Yeah,
hold on.
Okay, now you can press send. And from there, you're just waiting. For me, it wasn't very long. I actually got an email from MySpace the very next day.
Already?
Yeah, I know. Let's see what it says. Thank you for filling out the deletion form. I have scheduled the profile in question for removal. So I guess that was it. Please allow up to 72 hours. Dexter.
This is sincerely Dexter.
MySpace, more efficient than we thought.
My guess, Zach, is that like 90% of the staff is dedicated to deleting people's accounts at this point.
As it turns out, deleting your profile may not be the eye-rolling ordeal you'd imagine. And depending on what you find still there, if you happen to Google yourself, it could be a tremendous relief. So if you never deleted your old account, it might be time to do a little digital housekeeping. After all, there's really no such thing as MySpace or your space when it comes to the internet. It's everybody's space, for better and for worse. For Word of Mouth, I'm Taylor Quimby.
While Taylor simply sent an email to remove his MySpace account, it's not always so easy to protect your data trail. For more than a decade, Julia Angwin led a privacy investigation team for the Wall Street Journal. She was also part of the team that won a Pulitzer Prize for coverage of corporate corruption. In other words, she has a deep insider's knowledge of who's watching you, what they know, and why it matters. A few months ago, I spoke with Julia about the surveillance economy and the steps she takes to protect her data, as well as the price she pays for privacy, which was upwards of $2,500 last year. Here's what she had to say.
I mean, some of my steps were free, I would like to point out. So I did use, for instance, free software that protects my web browsing from being tracked by the advertisers that want to track you online. And I used some free software that anonymizes your location. It's called Tor, and basically makes it look like you're browsing from some place where you're not. But I also had to spend a lot of money on things that were very expensive. I got a separate phone, a burner phone that wasn't in my name, because essentially my phone is the perfect tracking device, and having it with me all the time, I realized that there wasn't that much I could do about it other than remove my name from it. So I basically got a phone paid with a fake name, and so that was very expensive to have a separate phone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, similarly, I got a cloud. Instead of using Google Docs, I paid $200 for an encrypted cloud service where the data is encrypted and only I can unlock it. So the company that stores it doesn't have any access to looking at it.
Mm-hmm. You paid for a privacy filter to shield your laptop screen from other voyeurs, a subscription for a portable internet service to bypass untrusted connections, $5 a month service to give you disposable email name and address. You're introducing many readers to the personal data protection market. Is this a reliable market yet? You found that some of them were not so.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate. This is a very new market, and I was thrilled to find that there were companies that would sell me some privacy products. But then I was really disappointed when some of them didn't pan out. So, for instance, I paid this company, Trusted ID, $35 to opt me out of the biggest data brokers, mostly because these companies make it very difficult to remove your data from them, and they're not well-known companies. And I thought, these people had a service. It might be easier than me sitting here and faxing them my driver's license and whatever else they wanted. But the problem was I paid the money, I waited a couple months, and then I thought, I wonder if this worked. How can I check? There's not really a way to check because these data brokers don't actually offer you access to your data. So essentially I called them as a reporter, each one, and said, did you opt me out? And unfortunately, yeah, I had been opted out of less than half of them.
You're an award-winning investigative reporter, Julia, but you carry a burner phone and a wallet lined with metallic film. I mean, should the rest of us be concerned or even scared?
I mean, I think that it's important for people to figure out what they're worried about and focus on that threat. You know, I sort of tried to address a whole range of threats so that people could sort of see what it took to protect their privacy. So on the phone front, I used the burner phone. I also had a bag that I put my phone in that blocks all the signals. You know, but some people might prefer what I did online in terms of switching off of Google search onto another search engine, DuckDuckGo. That might be the thing they're more concerned about, that their searches are not stored forever. So I hope that people will think about it and realize that whatever the thing they're worried about, there is probably a choice.
And that's Julia Angwin, author of the book Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. There are no privacy issues when you enter NHPR's car raffle. We don't require a Facebook password or an email account or banking information. Just a credit card for your tickets and a phone number to call you if you win. Here's how to throw your name into the hat.